Thank you, Yuka, Marie-José, the University of Jyväskylä, Fulbright Finland, for allowing me to be in Finland for the last few months, so I can't claim having brought Southern California weather to you today. I think it's all your doing. But it's a real pleasure to be here and to learn more about the West Network. I also want to thank all of you associated with the West Network and everyone who's here today instead of enjoying the sunshine outside. I think this network is extremely important. A lot of your work is from inside the West, of course, contextualizing, situating, demonstrating its social construction and its genealogies of meaning. Now, this conference understands the West, and here I'm taking this from the website, as a group of states globally hegemonic in many areas of life, such as scientific innovation, the economy, consumption, military force, medicine, technological development, press freedom, political regimes, and ideology. Also, some view the West as having imposed its own vision of the world by having hegemony over the production of knowledge in intellectual domains which have then become discrete: social sciences, humanities, sociology, religion, philosophy, its own vision of the world, the Western paradigm. And that for others to adopt this paradigm has long been held as a global criterion of success. And I would add also to this paradigm rationality, temporality, and enlightenment legacies of individualism. So in sum, this Western paradigm includes both universalizing assumptions about knowledge and knowledge generation, what is valid and not valid, and the separation of kinds of knowledges into different discrete spheres called disciplines. However, the organizers also note that as long as there have been Western hegemonies, there have been contestations of them. And so I'm going to start there and say, yes, absolutely, and they are critical sites of investigation and understanding. So I'm going to give a short answer to the central question posed by this conference, which is, are Western hegemonies declining? And my answer is, they're definitely being challenged, especially in academic discourse. I do international relations in an interdisciplinary fashion, although I'm a political scientist by training. But it is also important to note that Western hegemonies, and here I speak of political, sociological, medical, religious, and epistemic hegemonies, which are, of course, intertwined, that they have never been absolute in many parts of the world in practice. And that is also why they've caused so much trouble and expended so many resources to maintain. As Cynthia Enloe, a feminist scholar of international relations, says, it takes a lot of power to maintain the system. And I want to reconfigure the question a little bit. Should Western hegemony decline, getting into the politics of it? And my answer is yes. I hope that it's self-evident that I'm not talking about the direction of right-wing populism or increasing social divisions. Why should Western hegemonies decline? Because for me, increasingly in my own work in different parts of Africa, the Middle East, Europe, and North America, they mask and they also demean through an ongoing double move too much richness, too much of interest, too much knowledge in the world. And there exists too much in the ways of ontologies and modes of life, if you will, mode de vie, that everyone should learn from, that are more ecologically sound than what the West has put forth over the past several centuries at least. And finally, I think they should decline because, at least in the fields I work in, religion, humanitarianism, ethics, and international relations, they work to inhibit moves toward equality in multiple kinds of relationships across geographic, linguistic, religious, and ethnic boundaries. So instead, I think we need increasing exposure and understanding, expansion of, and openness to ontologies and knowledges and knowledge claims that are part of or constitutive of practices in different parts of the world. So today I want to describe first the work that the local often does in the fields that I truck in, why it is used and my critiques of it, including my own use of it, and now my critiques, and then describe some of the sites I've encountered in my own research on religion and humanitarianism in different parts of the world that caused me to question increasingly this term, the local, and try to find ways of conceptualizing what it is that I feel like I'm seeing, and I'm not the only one. These sites, experiences, and related knowledge claims, they trouble the compartmentalization of the local, and they delineate problems with the terms. And they also show how much work Western hegemonies take to maintain. Then, finally, I want to move to some recent international relations and interdisciplinary and feminist conceptualizations and talk about what insights and forms of knowledge they point to, and zero in particular on several fairly recent conceptualizations such as the pluriverse, globalectics, and feminist work on the transnational and worldism. And my purpose is not to offer a romanticized alternative from the vantage point of, you know, a Westerner as I am moving around in the global South, but rather to pinpoint experiences, places, and practices that demonstrate the ongoing power of this ephemeral construct of the West, and its power to denigrate and actively suppress other kinds of knowledges and cosmologies. But also, I want to think more about how, despite this ongoing denigration and suppression, we can see something of the ongoing persistence and power of practices, beliefs, and ontologies that challenge quote-unquote Western understandings of what is valid knowledge, what is the purpose of life, ways of conceiving of the world, and approaches to studying it. So I want to ask what happens if we look at these things not as local, but as collectively bringing forth an interconnected and powerful challenge to Western cosmology, rationalism, and progress. So why banish the local? Of course, the local is a long-standing term used in fields like anthropology to connote the practices, systems of belief, religious rituals, social mores, etc., of the sites of research of various scholars. The local can refer to a geographically limited space or site. More frequently for international relations and interdisciplinary studies, it refers to those practices, beliefs, and commitments, especially daily, quote-unquote, practices, that manifest themselves as different or differences, and therefore something to be curious about or investigated. Now, I say banish the local, but I understand that there are places and times when we speak of local government, it makes sense to talk about the local, or a local school policy, or something like that. Okay, so I want to make that aside. But the local reflects, for me, a longstanding tradition. For scholars like myself, those with a positionality like mine, that is white and Western, when we are interested in understanding others, the local is then used to challenge aspects of the construction and dominance of the West very often from experiences more or less outside of it. So I'm saying that there are good reasons to appeal to this thing called the local. It's very popular in my fields of humanitarianism, including development work, transitional justice, peace building, some kinds of feminism and religion. And I myself have often used the local in the past. I've used it in talks. The title of one article has the phrase local and global influences on peace building in Kenya. I've talked about it on the ethics of faith-based organizations, etc. So this particular picture shows one of the reasons for me why people like me appeal to the local. I took this in Yaoundé, the capital of Cameroon, and it's a bunch of signs of various humanitarian groups. Some are UN groups, some are transnational, Catholic Relief Services, etc. But they together form what some of us call the Humanitarian International, which is largely, quote unquote, Western or Northern in nature. The signs are kind of pointing in the same direction, a little bit confused, but mostly in the same direction, and they're mostly, this actually you can't really tell, but this is one of the nicer neighborhoods called Bastos of Yaoundé. And so when I started investigating quote-unquote local humanitarian groups as well as transnational groups, I saw that the power of particular modes of being of things like neoliberal discourses of aid, the privatization of aid, if you will, the necessity of meeting certain metrics, etc., and also discourses of the war on terror, to me those were the global, and I wanted to see how the local responded. So that the local could be a site of resistance as well as a site of imbrication and acceptance of these forms of power. Others talk about the local as having important sites for historical knowledge. Séverine Hautesser, who has written several books on peace building, is a former peace builder herself. She has talked about the privileging of the technical knowledge instead of local knowledge, and that local and technical knowledges should be put on the same plane. So there's a good reason why she appeals to the local. Jean-Paul Lederach is a very well-known scholar, practitioner of peace building and conflict resolution. He and Roger McGinty talk about things like the everyday and the local as well. We need local participation if these things are going to work. That's the whole idea. Okay. So this notion then, also in transitional justice, the more legal mechanisms of transitional justice, societies moving from conflict, presumably, to peace, these kinds of things differentiate the local from top-down models, if you will, that are externally imposed. And they're trying to figure out, and I've been trying to figure out, you know, what kinds of buy-in are possible, logical, desirable, etc. So the local in these cases has to do with participation and agency. And for feminist literature, at least in my field, the local is seen to be often that which is feminized, right? The quotidian, that sphere that is the domain of women. And so feminists want to elevate the term, again, people like Cynthia Enloe, to show that women and women's work are crucial for making the world go around. But increasingly, I find the return to the local problematic because it misses important elements of both power and difference in both the West and elsewhere. Of course, the question is difference with what and what kind of power? So as this network also indicates, that there's an idea about background knowledge, taken for granted knowledge, claims, and contexts of what we are calling the West in all its amoeba-like forms, and I don't want to say that it is one thing. And this would also include Enlightenment notions of individual reason, knowledge production and science, and Westphalian notions of political organization in the form of the state. So these things then are taken for granted as the global or that which should be globalized. And other practices, rituals, traditions, beliefs, commitments, and ontologies are called the local, and that bounds them. And it takes them out of their historical and intersectional contexts, I think. It tends to situate such sites as places of exoticism, difference, excitement, and sometimes fear. We can go back to Edward Said's critique of Orientalism. But it also downplays their connections and their influence, their actual and potential connections, and especially their influence. And, of course, it sets them up against this thing we call the universal, which is the West. And it accords it tremendous and wide-ranging power and durability despite its internal differences, and often accords it moral superiority. So finally, contrasting the local to the continuing discursive power of components of the West, or the global universal, often assumes a kind of temporality that is progressive and developmentalist, especially in the fields that I work in. So increasingly, I think we need to banish the local. So what are some things beyond the local? The top two pictures are pictures, one in Kenya, in East Africa, one in Senegal, in West Africa, of a group called Prometra, the promotion of traditional medicine. And Prometra is an international, we might call it a global organization of traditional healers. I've interviewed folks or interacted with folks involved in Prometra in Kenya, in Cameroon, in Central Africa, and in Senegal, but it also exists in Louisiana, in the U.S., it exists in the Far East, it exists in many parts of the world. So increasingly, I see something like that as beginning to evoke things that are, I would have thought of as local, but they're beyond the local. The bottom right picture is from also from Senegal, at the headquarters, kind of the local headquarters. And it's a picture of this Prometra organization, and it's a picture of a Sankofa, a healer, who also considers himself kind of a priest, a therapist, etc., you name it. He's a one-stop shop in a sense. Although if you go there with an ailment, you also get an intake interview, and they decide who's got the best set of expertise for whatever it is that ails you. And so I think of these things and how many places I've seen different or similar manifestations, not always the same, of course, but often very similar manifestations. Does anybody know what the bottom left is? It's here in Finland. It's the artwork at the Sami Parliament. And it's beautiful. It covers this entire wall. If you haven't been to the Sami Parliament building, I highly recommend it. I've been there twice now. And it's called Earth Mother Spirit, or Earth Water Mothers, one of the two. Anyway, same kinds of notions of a different way of conceiving, in a sense, of the world and our relationship to it, I suppose. So here I'm turning to what is beyond or different than, in my view, the local, that the local cannot really encapsulate or bound geographically or temporally. And I also want to think about the work that Western hegemonies do to maintain their claims as global and hence dominant. So for me, the more I think about religion in different parts of the world, I think that Max Weber was wrong. Of course, I like Weber. I wrote an article called A Neo-Weberian Approach to Religion. But he was wrong in that traditional religions, magic, etc., have not faded away. They have not become rationalized in the sense that he thought they would. In the way that he stipulated, as he showed so well, Christianity and many other world religions. Instead, they've shown tremendous staying power and influence and ongoing practice. So there's a lot of richness, marginalization, yet ongoing power of what has become known as African religion or African traditional religion, depending on where you are. And I think these terms are also very inadequate, but I use them in the sense of living tradition that people like Talal Asad, or in a very different way, Alistair MacIntyre, talk about. And so that, to me, says more than the usual Weberian sense of rationalization. And I think that it's important to understand their staying power vis-a-vis received traditions, Christianity, Islam, for example, in Africa, in many parts of Africa. And some things that kind of, you know, are interesting without saying they're the same, and I don't want to say that, but there are some commonalities. Notions of temporality are less progressive and linear, more cyclical. Notions of time. One of my colleagues, Siba Grovigi, who teaches at Cornell, he's from Guinea, and he says that in his mother's tongue, there's no past or future. And he said this at a conference, and another woman from Kenya, across the continent of Africa, spoke up and said in her mother's tongue, it was the same. There's no past or future. So what does this notion of present mean at the same time that there's a veneration of ancestors, for example, that there's this idea of responsibility to the earth, both in past and future? So political, social, and religious ontologies, I don't want to call them communal or communitarian, but they are in many ways less individualistic, again, including temporally the ancestors, very present in many of the places I have worked, also in Native American cosmologies. There are notions of what we tend to call nature or the environment, and one of the nice things about being here in Finland is that you disrupt a lot of the kind of my received Western notions of connections with nature. Everybody tells me that all the Finns love nature, and if there are some of you who are Finnish and who don't, I want to meet you so that, you know, I know that there's variety here too. But again, there's an idea that's more holistic, that's less adversarial, this idea of living with the rhythms and cyclical patterns instead of finding ever new ways to control. So we know a lot of this, but I've really been struck by this in my own research. So again, one of the aspects of religion, these traditional healers, I've had the opportunity to meet in several places. And of course, they also exist virtually all over the world, in Asia, East and South Asia, Latin America, the Caribbean, Australia, New Zealand, US Native Americans, etc. The use of and knowledge of plants, for example, in healing, but also not simply that, also the use of body and mind together as forms of healing, as forms of spirituality. Dancing being part of the healing ritual, for example, instead of kind of a body-mind split. Notions of music and language, storytelling, the role of griots in West Africa, as well as the printed word as means of knowledge, communication, and religious, social, and political experience. An idea of maintaining harmonies in the present, but also with the past, in order to ensure a good future. The idea that healers are also priests and religious guides very often. Now, I don't want to say, again, that these traditions are perfect. Ray Winconnell, a decolonial thinker, has talked about the misogyny, for example, of many both Western and non-Western systems, social systems alike. And it's also not to say that traditional healers or religions practice in the same way. But they do have important connections, I think, in terms of cosmologies that challenge what we think of very often as Western cosmologies, and they're very persistent and powerful. In some, for example, in Cameroon, I've met people who go to the priest, don't tell the healer, and they also go to the healer, don't tell the priest. Or in Ghana, people who openly do both, it's not a big deal. There are different ways of managing and negotiating these kinds of things. So I also want to note two things, though. There's an active suppression and supplanting, in my colleague Ngugi wa Thiong'o's words, of these ontologies, languages, religious expressions. It takes time and effort. It happened in the past, and it's ongoing in the present. Ngugi is a writer. He's from Kenya. If you are educated in Africa, you have probably read his work in a literature class. He's now a colleague of mine at UC Irvine. And he's been writing his memoirs. That's his kind of most recent project. So I think three volumes of his memoirs are out. And he talks very vividly about the active suppression under British colonialism of language, how he and others were punished for speaking Kikuyu. Now he writes first in Kikuyu, and then he will have it translated into English, or he will translate it. But he also talks about the active suppression of sacred sites or erasure of sacred sites in various parts of the continent. The statue of Cecil Rhodes that recently came, or a couple years ago came down in South Africa, was built purposely on a sacred site. And so he talks about these kinds of things in Kenya as well. And I think, you know, just thinking a little, scratching this a little bit more and thinking more about it, this kind of suppression of language happened all over the colonized world, of course. Another colleague on the blog that I co-edit is a doctor in South Africa, and he was with us in Senegal as we met these healers. And of course, he was fascinated by the knowledge that he did not receive in his medical training. And so he wanted to, but he also remembered his grandmother, who was something of a healer, and what she used. But that was all considered, you know, backwards. So this kind of thing is active suppression in many ways. Zimbabwe, there's a musician who is at University of California, Santa Barbara, and he has done work on the Mbira instrument. And how that instrument was also suppressed under Christian missionaries because it was seen to have spiritual meaning as well. So this kind of thing is active. I've read some of the papers of one of the Jesuit missionaries in Baja California, and how they actually went about encouraging and sometimes coercing Amerindians or indigenous Californians into the missions because they felt very much that their own diet, their own way of life was lacking, as well as their souls needed saving. And if we go back to the future into humanitarianism today, again, as Otisser points out, and as I have seen in my own interviews, there's this ongoing notion that technical expertise, which becomes a one-size-fits-all kind of thing, is constantly valued more than this thing that she calls local knowledge, and I'm trying to find another term for. So there are various kinds of efforts to recover these kinds of knowledges, but I think it's very important then to appreciate the ontology or ontologies of these ways of being and living, and especially their persistence, power, and interconnections. It could very likely lead to a healthier planet and healthier people living in it, as well as the recovery of memories that folks like Ngugi talk about a lot. So this is why, again, the dominance of Western hegemonies is an active and ongoing process, but never absolute, in my view. And I think that these pictures here are one indication of what I'm grappling with, of what is local, what is global. So on the left, that's a picture that's at the University of Cheikh Anta Diop in Dakar. It's a lab where they have gathered plants from all over the continent of Africa that are used in healing and talk about where and how they're used and what they're used for. Some of these are 100 years old, some of these sheets, because this was a project begun by the French, and the French started gathering this in what I would call an extractive mode of knowledge gathering. So I think that this is, you know, very interesting. The picture in the middle on top is of Amadou Bamba, who is the founder of the Mourid Brotherhood, one of the Muslim brotherhoods in Senegal, which is very different from the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, of course. And to me, this is an indication of the differences, one of the many ways in which Islam is practiced around the world, right? But it's not simply local. It's at least national and across more than Senegal, through much of the Sahel. These brotherhoods are quite powerful. And they see themselves as in opposition to the Wahhabism coming out of Saudi Arabia, for example. The bottom right, again, is the Association of Traditional Healers, this one in Senegal. And again, is it local? Is it global? What is it? And in the middle is actually a picture from Italy, from the town of Gubbio, because as I work on religion and have been thinking about these things, I've been thinking about the practices of Catholicism. My last name is Lynch. It's an Irish name. I grew up Irish-American Catholic. And one thing that's interesting about Irish Catholicism and spirituality, also poetry and music, is that they're very infused by Celtic and Druidic ontologies and beliefs, if you will. If you go to Gubbio in Italy, those are two doors for the same residence, and all of the old town buildings have this. And the raised up door is the door of the dead. And so it's for the spirits to go in and out. So my point here is that Christianity is practiced differently in many parts of the quote-unquote West, and yet it is put forth to other parts of the world as something that is pure from its Western origins. And in fact, so we need to complicate that notion of the purity of any kind of religious tradition and any kind of knowledge. So where do we go with all of this? Some new, or not all new, completely new, but terminology that is beginning to cross more disciplines, I think. How do we conceptualize? I've been thinking of how do I conceptualize what it is I'm trying to get at? How can we reconfigure the basis for discourse and discursive power about the West, about Western hegemonies, about things that are not of the West? How do we conceptualize them? In my field, the critique of Western epistemological and ontological claims, Western rationality, individualism, has been growing louder for quite some time. So the field of international relations, for example, is increasingly addressed issues of race and religion, or what we might call Western parochialism that exists simultaneously with Western dominance. There are increasingly studies of the histories, traditions, and politics from non-European and non-North American parts of the world. The Press Rutledge has two series of interest here, Worlding Beyond the West and Interventions, and both of them try to disturb the categories of the West. And then there's a critique that's also on the rise of Eurocentric origins and the development of the field, the racialized development of the field, actually, and its relationship to colonialism and imperialism. And I could cite a number of authors who are part of these endeavors. So I think that this body of work is crucial for any ongoing decentering of the West in the fields I work in. And relatedly, a group of decolonial scholars in other fields are advancing the term pluriverse, which I want to talk about. My colleague Ngugi talks about globalectics. And Lily Ling, who is a feminist scholar of international relations who tragically died last year, was very influential in her book, The Tao of World Politics, or talking about worlding. So I want to talk about these things as possible alternatives. So the decolonial scholars use the term pluriverse. Some of this came out of, originally, apparently, the Zapatista movement in southern Mexico. Zapatista rebel movement in southern Mexico, which was seen to be an indigenous movement. These are, and it was taken up by scholars like Enrique Dussel, who was also a liberation theologian. Walter Mignolo wrote a book in the mid-90s on this. Arturo Escobar, and more recently, Silvia Rivera, Cusicanqui, Ray Winconnell, etc. So the idea here is to advance the idea of a multiplicity of cosmologies and forms of knowledge as a challenge to Western universalizing claims. And so it banishes, in a sense, the idea of this essentialized local that can be known or defined by an international, who might be well-intentioned and seek to listen, but often constructs these entities as bounded entities out there. The idea of the pluriverse creates a possibility of being in and knowing multiple worlds simultaneously. At least that's the goal of folks like Mignolo and others. So Mignolo talks about inhabiting the border, the boundaries, or the borderlands. I would call it the limited liminal spaces of both Western and non-Western worlds, cosmologies, and spiritualities. A former student of mine, Marco Scalzo, wrote his dissertation on decolonial thought in Bolivia, and he says that he imagines the pluriverse as a possibility of a multi-layered map of relationships simultaneously crossing bodies and geohistorical contexts from different angles. But he wonders, Marcos does, if it's still too bounded for some of the decolonial thinkers temporally and spatially, and he uses a lot of the work of the feminist decolonial theorist Silvia Rivera Cusicanqui, who tries to keep even these notions of the pluriverse unbounded, if you will, that the things are constantly shifting, if you will, that it goes beyond territorial contexts or geohistorical contexts. So it can get fairly complex, but it's also an attempt not to say we're ever going to get rid of this thing called the West, but to understand from the perspective of other cosmologies, and especially coming out of the Latin American decolonial context. Ngugi, my colleague who I mentioned before, wrote a book called Globalectics. He also has a book that he wrote a very long time ago called Decolonizing the Mind. And Globalectics is kind of his sort of summary, if you will, of how, or of some of his ideas about decolonizing the mind. And for him, this is primarily linguistic, that different languages that are repressed or have been repressed need recovering, that gives access to different meanings, different understandings, as well as cosmologies. And he talks about poor theory. He says, poor people are very inventive, they're very innovative, when they're poor in either the material sense or in the sense of their ontologies and languages being suppressed or actively erased. And so he focuses on how colonial power infuses and reshapes or suppresses these languages, practices, and meanings, and the mechanisms by which it does so in order to reveal and recover what is suppressed. He also doesn't think one is going to get rid of the West, but he thinks that it definitely, that there needs to be kind of a renewal for him of Pan-African ideas of taking back power. Lily Ling, her notion of worldism comes out of a Taoist notion of yin and yang. She argues that Taoist dialectics complicate Western international relations. She positions that as the yang within the dialectic and says that other epistemologies, including those of the arts, represent yin, but that both co-create, co-govern, co-exercise power. But they're not necessarily in balance. So for her, we need an epistemic compassion, if you will, to encourage exploration of this creative power of the yin, to challenge the yang. And again, you know, there are issues with any one of these conceptualizations, I think. But I think in each, while the West remains, it remains slightly differently, and as one among many. And these terms then are marinating, if you will, in my own mind and my own work. I don't want to offer clear boundaries around them and clear differences, but rather I would like to encourage the exploration and openness to each as ways of decentering the West. Now, in my own work, I've used the term syncretism quite a lot to connote the blending of the colonial with the pre-colonial, as well as the post-colonial. I think, though, that we need to reject the use of terms like hybridity and syncretism to analyze only post-colonial societies and pre-colonial religions and ritual practices. In my discussion of Italian Catholicism, Irish Catholicism, for example, they're already hybrid. Any particular expression, religious expression, I would argue, is already a hybrid. So I think we need to discursively put these things on the same plane. Now, some of the efforts I've been involved in, the top is a blog that I'm one of six co-editors. Four of the other co-editors are based at different institutions in Africa. We try to bring religious voices to the fore, but also voices critical of religion and critical of representational issues in humanitarianism. On the left, there's a new organization, well, it's about 5 years old now, the African Studies Association of Africa, the ASAA, and it's having its third biannual conference in Nairobi in October. And the idea very much is to foreground African knowledges, if you will, and also to bring the core of studies about Africa back to the continent. They have been for some time in Europe, in the US, in North America, and the idea is, shouldn't they be in Africa, actually? And that they come out of, this is sort of a reverse move then, to showcase, to encourage citation of African scholars, et cetera. It's supported by the African Studies Association in the US. Also, recent work on the ASA in the US, which was founded in the late 50s, early 60s, 1960s, shows how it was founded in part as part of a Cold War project to securitize different parts of Africa, and also that it, from the start, tended to sideline black scholars in the US as well as African scholars in Africa. Now, that's changed enormously now, but it's as that history, I think, is part of this how we see this sort of active suppression of different kinds of knowledge. And I also found this conference called Troubling the Grounds, Global Configurations of Blackness, Nativism, and Indigeneity, just happened last week at my university. I know some of the folks involved in it. I didn't know it was happening. I obviously didn't make it. But I think it's another indication, and it's really what I'm trying to do here, is to trouble the grounds. So I've argued that it's been too tempting to relegate practices and ontologies in some parts of the world to the local, and that the categories of the local and the global need to be disturbed. And I ask, what happens if we instead seek their implicit and explicit interconnections, what knowledge claims are disturbed, and what other claims are advanced? And I think in my fields of ethics, religion, and humanitarianism, the implications would be huge for reversing paternalism and aid relationships, for example, for advancing equality in our understanding of otherness and humility in understanding ourselves, and for learning how to act to be better stewards of the planet. So for me, this is both a political and a discursive project. How we name has implications. So, kitos. Thank you very much.